Hi there, and welcome to a new episode of Korean in Context podcast. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Chad.
As you can tell, I'm joined by my delightful colleague, Sarah Yoon, from the Korean Economic Institute. Basically, I had to take a vacation for the recording of our second episode. I was actually in North Korea while a podcast on North Korea was being recorded with Dr. Andrew Ilankov. If you don't know him, I don't know where you've been. He's one of the most esteemed Russian North Korea analysts out there. He's the author of Crisis in North Korea, Failure of De-Stalinization, and North of the DMZ, amongst others. He's also a prolific columnist for Asia Times, Daily NK, and the Korea Times. So, Sarah, how was your conversation with Dr. Lankov?
Yeah, it was actually very interesting. And we talked for a long time about a variety of issues related to North Korea, from inter-Korea relations to U.S.-North Korea relations to post-reunification, etc.
Yeah, well, actually, I have taken a listen to it, and must say, it came out of the podcast very, very interesting. It was a rather depressing outlook for the future of the Korean Peninsula. Did you get any sense of hope from him for the future of, you know, inter-Korean relations?
That's a good question, because he does paint a very pessimistic or gloomy picture of North Korea. But I took it as him trying to paint a realistic picture of North Korea rather than a depressing picture, per se. And he was about telling us, look, these are the realities of North Korea. And these are the misunderstandings that we have about North Korea. These are the policy faults and policy successes that we've had in the past. And this is how we can move forward. So he didn't exactly use the word hope, per se, but he wasn't utterly hopeless about it, in a sense that there is hope for engagement and future relations with North Korea.
And, you know, Lankov is one of the sort of go-to men for North Korea. Like, he, as I said, he writes a lot on it, and his writings have a lot of traction. Why do you think people go to Lankov so much? Like, what do you think is unique about him compared to, you know, other analysts working on the Koreas?
I think there are largely three things, in my opinion. The first is that he has a Soviet background, so he has the firsthand experience of living in a communist bloc under a totalitarian regime, and then seeing the collapse of that regime. So from that sense, he has a very unique perspective on North Korea compared to some American or South Korean experts on North Korea. The second thing is, I think he is just very brutally honest and straightforward, and to many people, watchers of North Korea, that's refreshing, because you start of hearing the same answers, same stories over again, yeah, in North Korea in the policy circle. And then the third thing is, he actually has firsthand experience in living in North Korea in the 1980s. He studied in Kim Il-sung University during an era where not a lot of foreigners had access to North Korea.
Right, yeah. Okay, well, with that, I think it's a good time to take a listen to the interview. And as I understand it, you start on that very topic, on his life in North Korea in the 1980s. Let's take a listen.
And so you've mentioned that you visited North Korea.
Yes, for 1 year.
For one year.
Yeah.
How was your stay in North Korea in the 1980s?
Interesting, privileged, because we were much isolated from the average North Korean world, but less than all other foreigners, because foreigners lived exclusively in ghetto. In embassies, there were some technical missions, but they did not interact with North Koreans at all. Our interactions were limited and controlled but still existed. And in some cases, I could even have very frank conversations with the North Koreans. And as a matter of fact, it's often perceived that even in the 70s, especially in the 70s, 80s, North Koreans were brainwashed robots who just spent days and nights dreaming how they would die for the dear leader. Nothing like that. They were very smart people who basically saw through the official propaganda in many cases. Not completely, but they did not buy it wholesale. And they were very smart. At least people with whom I could interact, students of the university. But there were many restrictions at the university to start with. We were not allowed, we were students of Kim Il-sung University, but we were not allowed to attend classes together with Korean students. Only special classes for foreigners. We did not really mix with Korean students at the university. Dorm was segregated too, but in dorm we could share if we wished. Most people did so, shared a room with a North Korean student.
Since then, from no relations to now, do you think there has been progress in the U.S.-North Korea and inter-Korea relations?
What do you mean by progress?
Progress.
Over the last 15 years, from 1995 to 2009, the United States provided North Korea with roughly 2.4 million tons, don't quote me on that, roughly 2.4 million, 2.5 million tons of food aid. They are the third largest provider of food aid. And this is what North Koreans wanted. Because the reason why relations began to develop, well, above all, North Korean government, when it lost Soviet support, Soviet aid in the early 1990s, they began to look for other ways to compensate for the inefficiencies of the economy. And, of course, the best way was to squeeze aid from the outside world, using diplomacy, using nuclear developments, everything. And in this regard, they are very successful. Actually, North Korean government is often described as insane, irrational. They are brilliant. They are rational, they are brilliant, they are the best bunch of Machiavellians currently in operation worldwide. They know what they want, they have a very long-term strategy. They plan years ahead, and they usually succeed.
And how does that compare to, say, U.S. or South Korean policy towards North Korea? Do you see consistency? Do you see a long-term goal or vision?
I don't see any long-term goal. In South Korea, the North Korean issue has become an important part of ideological debate. They're so-called South Korean progressives. I would better describe them as leftist nationalists or nationalist left. They tend to have, used to have, in their youth, they were usually student activists, and they had a lot of sympathy towards North Korean Stalinist regime. A bit of residual sympathy still exists, and on balance, they believe that interactions are necessary, that it's important to be nice to North Korea, and their assumption is that if they are nice, North Korea will somehow recover. Parts of this group, very small, believe that recovery will be possible under the current system, essentially a copy of economic management system of Stalin-era Soviet Union. Many more assume that reforms, North Koreans would sooner or later embark on the way of reforms, generally similar to those of China, and still achieve economic breakthrough. I believe that these expectations are completely unfounded, completely wishful thinking. The problem with conservatives is they are not much better. Again, I would not describe them as conservatives. They are right. Because they are very different from American conservatives in many regards. They don't care much about abortion or, you know, school prayer. Simply not, it's not such issue, absolutely completely beyond their interest. Completely different. And they are not so much about conservatives. They are largely pro-market. So anyway, the South Korean right, they do have some ideas, but they excessively believe in power of hardline. But what is important, both the South Korean left and the South Korean right does not really care about North Korea that much. For them, North Korea is largely a tool, a symbol to be used in their own domestic dispute. They're not going to have a consistent North Korean policy because they don't want to achieve much in dealing with North Korea. They just want to use this issue for domestic political gains, largely. So no, they don't. Short answer is no, South Korea doesn't have consistent policy in dealing with North Korea. And it's basically South Korea over the last 10 years, even more, maybe 15, is losing the sense of the goal. Because have you asked every South Korean 20 or 30 years ago what should be the major goal in dealing with North Korea? Pretty much everybody would tell you unification. Nowadays, lip service to the unification is still paid. But it's clear that actual interest in the unification is dying out really fast. Really fast. Among the South Korean youth, they are not going to see unification as the supreme goal. They are very reluctant to admit it openly because it's against entire education. All official ideologies available, but in the depths of their heart, they would probably prefer indefinite continuation of the status quo. In the U.S., we have different sets of problems. First of all, we have the same right-left divide, which is sort of similar with South Korea. Fortunately, in the U.S., neither right nor left perceives North Korea as a part of internal ideological debate, but it still creates trouble. And other problem is that for the Americans, North Korea is not that important. The only reason why the U.S. care about North Korea, the only reason why a U.S. president is capable, I hope, to find Korea on the world map is nuclear program. And this is essentially the only worry of the United States. And once again, there is the same oscillation between negotiations. The idea that North Koreans can essentially be bribed into denuclearization and sanctions, which I would describe as an idea that North Koreans can be blackmailed into denuclearization. There is a bad news, they are not going to be blackmailed and they are not going to be bribed. Neither strategy is going to work. But this very short institutional memory in the United States and this essentially a low level of interest in North Korean issues, might take decades before it will become clear.
Since the 2010 incidents of Cheonan and Yeonpyeong Island, there have been signs that the inter-Korea relations have been on the road to improvement. What do you think are the prospects for inter-Korea relations in 2011, 2012, and beyond?
Wait and see. The most important factor will be the outcome of the next elections in South Korea later next year, December. Depending who is going to win, if the South Korean right stays in power, which now seems likely, but by no means certain, we are going probably to have more or less continuation of the Cold War. Even though I hope that the next South Korean government will be right-leaning government, will be softer on North Korea than the current one. If we are going to have the nationalist left coming back to power, which is not highly likely, but not it's possible, not likely, but possible, they will probably resume large-scale unconditional economic aid to North Korea. And I believe so that for the next year or so, entire North Korean policy in dealing with South Korea will be largely determined by their desire to increase probability of the electoral victory of the South Korean nationalist left, because they see these people as useful allies. I don't have problems with that, because on balance I believe that the policies of the national left are in many regards more rational and more, I would welcome these policies. Usually I support these policies because of reasons, due to reasons which are very different from the reasons the nationalist left in South Korea believe in. So basically the relations between two Koreas will be determined largely by this desire to influence the outcome of the next elections in North Korea. It might mean new summits, frenzy of diplomatic activity. It might mean new provocations we don't know yet, because a lot will be determined by the changes in the domestic political atmosphere inside South Korea.
With that said, what are some practical, concrete steps that the two Koreas can take to be on the road for improvement?
To be realistic. North Korea, I would not give any advice to North Korea, because they don't need my advice. They don't care about good or bad relations. They just care about survival and money. And they need money largely because they need survival. They are not looking for money just for the sake of money. So they need to configure the international situation in a way which would allow them to get aid, to get assistance from a number of sponsors. Ideally, these sponsors should be quarreling between themselves. So North Korean diplomacy would be capable to use their contradictions and feuds, contradictions between the sponsors, in order to get as much as possible without giving much in exchange. So now North Koreans want better relations with South Korea and in the United States, but they don't want it for the sake of better relations. They want it because they assume, probably correctly, that such better relations will give them more opportunities to extract aid, unconditionally, ideally. They are too dependent on China now, they are not happy about it. So talking about South Korea, I think it's time to become realistic. South Koreans should understand that sanctions and pressure are not going to work. The demand for the apology about Cheonan incident was a non-starter from the very beginning, because North Koreans never say they are sorry. They did it only once with the abduction of the Japanese citizens, and they were immediately punished for their honesty. They are not going to repeat this mistake again. They are not going to be honest again, because they have learned hard way that honesty is not rewarded in diplomacy. Imagine, for example, what if North Koreans really admit that they did attack Cheonan? What will be the reaction? Can you imagine the South Korean public, tearing and saying, oh, our poor brothers, now they have found right way? No, South Korean public do what the Japanese public did after the admissions about abductions. The South Korean public will go ballistic, and North Koreans probably suspect it. But generally, as a rule, they never say sorry. So it's a non-starter. And it's important to understand that you cannot talk with North Koreans just for the sake of talking. North Koreans need talks as a way to get money. And if you want to have North Korean engaged, if you want to make sure that North Koreans are not staging military operations, which are misleadingly called provocations, because these are not provocations. They don't want to provoke. They're just sending signals. So to make sure that they will not send these signals using torpedoes and artillery shells, the best way is, to pay them, to provide them with aid, provide them with some amount of payments. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Otherwise, they will keep raising tensions on assumption that sooner or later the United States and South Korea will give in and start providing aid.
Now, what about China? Many argue that China is also interested in driving a wedge between the two Koreas. Will they ever let go of North Korea?
Well, on balance, I would say the Chinese interests in the area are clearly easily definable, and that the Chinese interests and goals in Korean in and around Korean Peninsula, they create a hierarchical structure. First of all, China needs stability. China needs stability in the region. Second, China would like to have North Korea divided. Korean Peninsula divided. Because, and the third, China would like to see a non-nuclear North Korea. The goals are hierarchical. Stability is much more important than division, and division is more important than denuclearization. So I think that basically Chinese leadership about 10 years ago made a strategic decision that North Korea is not going to collapse anytime soon, so it makes sense to provide North Korea with a limited amount of support to ensure, first of all, stability on the Korean Peninsula and status quo. Second, to keep Korean Peninsula divided. The question is, how much China is going to spend? I believe that there is a certain limit nobody is aware about, including the Chinese themselves. There is a certain amount of money and efforts and resources they are willing to spend on keeping North Korea above the water. If there is a serious crisis, which might mean that China will have to dramatically increase its economic and financial and political assistance to North Korea, it's open to doubt to which extent Chinese will be willing to do so. However, on the current stage, China can keep North Korea afloat at a very low cost, and that all probability they will continue doing it.
Well, this may be in direct contradiction with their identity of being a harmonious world leader, because they're supporting a regime that causes quote-unquote provocations. So how does China make sense of this conflict in identity?
Well, to start with, I would probably disagree with you. Yes, North Korea is a very unpleasant regime, but it's seen as an exceptionally provocative anything regime, largely from Washington and some European capitals. For many people in the world, North Korea is a brave small David who is challenging American Goliath. It's the same as for many people in China. And second, talking about the kind of, harmony and everything, China can always say, we are keeping stability, we are engaged with North Korea because it's a way to keep stability, and we are helping our poor neighbor, providing it with aid, otherwise many North Koreans would probably starve to death. Well, it's their logic, honestly dishonest logic, but most of the statements in diplomacy are not exactly frank and honest. But anyway, you can easily see what Chinese probably can say about it. And I don't see they're really suffering from this contradiction, because this contradiction largely exists in the minds of the Americans, maybe Germans, British, but not much outside that. Developed, privileged Western world.
Many people believe that North Korea's economy is improving.
Yes, I do. Me too.
And there's no real assessment of a famine in North Korea. So how do you assess the current state?
Normal. No famine. People are malnourished. Many people are malnourished, but they have been malnourished for entire history of North Korea. Because if you look at the biometric statistics, essentially about height of the people, you will discover that the average height of the South Koreans dramatically increased since the collapse of the Japanese colonial rule, especially since the late 60s, when South Koreans began to eat well and began to consume a large amount of animal protein. And in North Korea, you see the opposite picture. Their average height slightly decreased compared to what it used to be in essentially colonial era. So they have always been malnourished. It's not in use. There is no famine. Prices are stable. There is a small but growing number of rich North Koreans, mostly related to the black market. Some of them are successful businessmen, illegal but very powerful businessmen, even though entire activity is illegal. Some of them are officials who are in position to take good bribes, usually from these businessmen. So you can see a dramatic increase in traffic in Pyongyang. You can go to very good restaurants in Pyongyang. A significant number of North Korean households now have DVD players. Pretty much every single one has a TV set, which was absolutely unthinkable just 10 years ago. A computer is not really a sign of luxury anymore. Yes, it's a sign of affluence, but, as I would say, like a good imported European car in the United States. Not every family wants it, not every family can afford it, but it's not that really exceptional, not that exceptional to drive a BMW or Mercedes. Not common, but not exceptional. Same is in North Korea with computers. Computers are their Mercedes, if you like, their Porsches, to show off and also. Well, so economy is doing reasonably well. Mild economic growth. Still, the gap between North Korea and its neighbors is increasing. There are no signs of a really economic boom, but there is a mild but noticeable improvement. Of course, it's much better than 10 years ago.
With economic improvement of North Korea, do you believe that the mindset of the North Koreans will also change?
Yes, but it's not going to follow anytime soon. Because mindsets, people are very conservative, especially once they turn 30, they become conservatives, and conservative they become, I mean not political conservatism. They are slightly suspicious about new ideas. They are careful, they are not in a hurry to change their opinions and worldview. So, in the long run, yes, it will change. It might be a really long time. It's often assumed that if North Korea has another famine, it might produce a revolution. Well, probably. But far more likely that nothing is going to happen, because revolutions don't start when people are starving. When people are starving, they have no time for revolution. They are too busy looking for food. If you look at the revolutions, they usually start in when the government is doing reasonably well, and when the people are doing reasonably well, and when the government usually wants to start some, initiate some reforms and improvements, and the government as a result gets overthrown. If they start reforms, well, sometimes it gets out of control, starting from the French Revolution. Now North Koreans have some time to talk. They have better access to information. So yes, in the long run, it's bad for the region. But once, as I have said, usually such changes in opinions, they might easily take many, many years, decades.
With the year 2012 approaching, and North Korea's declared that 2012 will be a year where they will enter into the gateway of strong and prosperous nation, do you foresee the prospects of regime collapse? And how do we make sense of regime collapse and the 2012 campaign?
I don't see regime collapse coming anytime soon. As I have said, and I repeat, unless North Korean government makes some grave mistakes, they are likely to stay in power, at least until the eventual death of Kim Jong-il. It's highly likely that the regime will outlive Kim Jong-il and will stay in control for decades. I am repeating, decades. We can be talking essentially about the same problems in this room in the year, say, 2025. I would not be surprised. I would not be even surprised if we are going to talk about it in this room in the year 2032. Quite possible. They're not going to collapse unless they do something stupid like reforming themselves, which is a great stupidity. To emulate China is not a rational policy. It's a completely irrational, dangerous stupidity for the regime. Even though for a vast majority of North Korea it would be a good news. They're not going to collapse. Not going to collapse unless they do something stupid. Next year we are going to see a lot of celebrations. And this is one of many reasons they are so persistent in their demand for aid, because they want to spend this aid to create festive mood in April next year, the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung. So there will be festive mood in Pyongyang, a lot of statements. The North Korean government will tell that we have finally succeeded. They will put glass finished, finally, completely. I think it's almost close to completion. At the Yugyeong Hotel, they will build few new houses, which will be on the TV. There will be, as I have said, celebrations, mass rallies, mass games, a lot of indoctrination sessions, and it's all.
My last question is, as a North Koreanist, given such bleak outlook on North Korea's reform and future, what motivates you to continue to work on and study North Korea?
It's an unusual society. The Korean Peninsula became a kind of, you know, in history we don't have experience. And so the Korean Peninsula became a stage for two unusual experiments. First of all, as a result of Korean division, we had two states. One took a very extreme choice, maybe not choice, maybe it was pressed to choose, a very extreme type of Stalinist, centrally planned state economy. Another chose a particular type of market economy. Wonderful experiment. Then we can see, actually, when we are talking about North Korea of the 60s and 70s, we can see how, if we study it, we can see what the state can do and what it cannot do about the society. Because North Korea under Kim Il-sung, especially in the 60s and 70s, was probably the world's most controlled society. The world has never seen anything like that before or after. How it worked, and to which extent it worked, because it did not always work. Sometimes it did, sometimes not. Then we saw a gradual collapse of this system, which is also very interesting. It was a kind of scorched earth by the late 80s in terms of market economy. And we saw how the market economy began to reemerge. It once again shows that in the modern world, it's natural for humans to trade and to do business. Sounds terribly rightish. Well, to placate the left, I will frankly tell, I don't like people who are successful in trade. I don't like them. Because I believe that business and success and commercial success is seldom compatible with good human qualities. But like it or not, it's how our society arranged. And it probably does agree with human nature. Maybe not with the best part of human nature. And when we look at these changes, it's interesting. We see the emergence of capitalism. We see how the developments, which say in Europe or in Japan, in Korea, not North Korea, earlier Korea, took centuries, pressed into years, compressed. It's very interesting. And we can see it just now. So it is an extremely interesting country. And on top of that, honestly, even though I'm skeptical, pessimistic, I believe that, well, we must do something to get North Koreans out of trouble. I mean, common people. Because this time, everybody in Washington is talking about nuclear U.S. state interest. Yes, I'm cynical. I understand that sovereign state has to care above all, exclusively or above all, only about its own interest. So I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not saying that Americans should, you know, get involved with all injustices of the world. Even more, I would say it would be a very bad idea for both the United States and the world. But having said that, I believe that North Koreans became victims of history. Yes, they, or to a very large extent, their grandfathers and grandmothers, are to a very large extent responsible for that. It's true. But when they made their political decisions back in the 1940s and 1950s, they could not know the future. They made decisions, which appeared to be absolutely logical back in 1945 or 1955, which appeared logical and moral. Communism had a great appeal. So, yes, it was to a very large extent their choice. Well, again, partially forced on them by the Russians and Chinese, but not only. There was a great support from below. Nonetheless, they now became trapped. They are trapped now. And it's best, and if possible, I'm not saying about everybody, at least for myself, I think I should do what I can to help the North Koreans escape this trap. And when I talk North Koreans, I'm talking about both the Kim family and the political prisoners in extermination camps. Because, surprisingly, they both ruling elite and the people at the very bottom of society, they are both victims of this system. They are victims of history. You know, it's another good example, that brilliant example, that in history, good intentions don't always produce good results. People who established North Korean state were largely noble, selfless freedom fighters. The result, as we have seen, is a total mess. And the worst government Korea has ever had in its history. And deaths of millions of people. But all this disaster was triggered by people with very good and very noble intentions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lankov, for an interesting and fascinating and engaging podcast interview. And we hope your stay in Washington was good and productive, and we hope to see you next time.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Well, thanks for listening to the Korean Context podcast today. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd really recommend you go and visit our website, keia.podbean.com. We've got a link up there which will allow you to subscribe to the series. Doing so means you'll never miss an episode, and all of the future MP3s will be delivered straight to your media player. In addition, while you're there, do please leave us some feedback. You know, we're always keen to hear from listeners, and it's always great to talk to people about future episodes, you know, people that could be worth talking to. So do get in touch and spread the word. Tell your friends, tell your enemies. You know, the podcast is free and you can point them to our website, keia.podbean.com, where they can check out all of our past episodes and subscribe, obviously, to the stream for future. So hope you enjoyed the episode today, and do look forward to being with you again soon. Thanks very much.